Okay, before we start, let us pay homage to the Buddha first. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Today, my discussion is the purposes of the spiritual practice. We all are practicing the Dharma. But what is the purpose of the practice? We must ask this question to make clear the purpose of our practice so that we will not be deviated from the path. To me, there are two purposes. Number one is immediate purpose. Number two is ultimate purpose. So what is the immediate purpose of the practice? The immediate purpose is to overcome our habitual reactions of likes and dislikes. We always behave in a similar way, in a pattern. For example, when our eyes come to contact with agreeable or pleasing object, immediately our mind grabs the object. We like it. We like the pleasing and agreeable objects. On the other hand, if our eyes come to contact with disagreeable and displeasing object, and we feel we reject it, we reject it compulsively. We do not like it. So we always react with like and dislike towards the six sense object that come into six sense spaces. When our ear hear some abusive word, then immediately we feel dislike. But if we hear some praise, some praise word, then immediately we like it. Or when we hear some good music, then we like it. And if our nose come to contact with good smell, then we like it. And if our nose come to contact with bad smell, immediately we reject it. We do not like it. Similarly, when our tongue come to contact with delicious food, we like it. On the other hand, if our tongue come to contact with bitter food, then we do not like it. And if our body come to contact with soft, smooth material or tangible things, then we like it. But if our body comes to contact with harsh things, rough things, then we do not like it. So this is what we call habitual reactions. Whatever pleasant, agreeable things, we like it immediately. On the other hand, if the object is unpleasant, displeasing, then we reject it compulsively. We do not like it. This is called habitual patterns of reactions. Am I right? Do you react in this way or not? Yes. So this is called habitual patterns of reactions. So what is the fault? What is the danger if we react in such a way again and again? Such reactions, such habitual reactions leave behind karmic potencies. Leave behind three types of karmic potencies. Number one, such reaction leave behind current life effective karma. Second, it leaves behind next life effective karma. And lastly, it leaves behind indefinitely effective karma. What is current life effective karma? Let's say when somebody abuses us, our habitual pattern of behavior or reaction is we don't like it. We don't like it activate the latent tendency of anger. We don't like it is always associated with anger. So if the mind gets angry because of abusive word, because we do not contemplate, do not mindful of the abusive word, then we react spontaneously, immediately with anger, and that anger mind can produce four elements in the body. Among the four elements, what are the four elements we have learned yesterday, right? Patavi, earth element; Apo, water element; Vayo, Patavi, Apo, Tejo, heat element or temperature element; and lastly, Vayo element, wind element, Vayo Dhatu, wind element. Among these four elements, the temperature of fire element become excessive because of anger mind. So when the mind gets angry, this state of mind immediately produce four element, that fire element becomes excessive. And because of excessive fire element, then your face turn to red, become red. And the fire element also activate the wind element. And because of excessive wind element, then your body shake. Your heart pumps very fast. And your body start to shake. So you are in miserable state, as if the karma is punishing us on the spot at this moment. This is called current life effective karma. Not only that, if anyone who has heart disease, because of this anger that produce fire element and activate the wind element, at this moment those who have heart disease may even get heart attack. And if this person is Deva, angel, Deva, deities, he might die at this moment. I have one friend, one fellow nun. When she recollected her past life, she saw in her fifth life, she was male Deva. And he served more powerful Deva, and he also fall in love with one female Deva. But this female Deva gradually finally left him to follow after another more powerful male Deva. And he was very, very angry. Very, very angry and feel very jealous about the more powerful Deva. And because of that anger, his life was immediately cut off. And he died on the spot and was reborn in hungry ghost in the darkness. So when he died and reborn in hungry ghost realm in the darkness, this become next life effective karma. So current life effective karma, if we always react with dislike when the object is disagreeable, then it produces a lot of unwholesome energy in the body as well as in the mind. Every of our experience, every of our habitual reaction with anger leave very strong impression, leave imprint in the mental stream, in the mental continuity. Let's say one time, when people tell something you do not like to hear, then you get very angry. And second time, you get angry again. Third time, you get angry again. Then it become a pattern, and this reaction, this anger reaction, leave strong impression, imprint on the mental continuity that it can carry forward to the next life. And next life, this person will become anger temperament. Easily he feel irritated, agitated. So this Deva, just now I mentioned, he died and reborn in hungry ghost. After fifth life, now he became a nun, a British nun. And she told me that she still can feel the anger she had on her fifth past life. This means that the anger carried forward up to the present life. And this lifetime, she told me she was anger temperament because of fifth life impression, imprint. So therefore, our habitual reaction, whether we react with greed or with anger, it leaves behind karmic tendency, not only in present life, current life, but next life. And next life, and in this life, before death takes place, if that karma ripen, whenever we react with greed or with aversion, when that karma ripen during our dying moment, then we will be reborn next life in one of the four woeful states. There's no doubt about it. Even that life, if in this life, whatever reaction, unwholesome reaction with greed and hatred does not mature during dying moment, but mature in the next life, and the anger will produce ugliness in our next life. If we are lucky enough to be reborn as human being, we will become very ugly person because of past life karma. And this also can become the next life effective karma. Okay. Therefore, whatever reaction we have will affect current life, also will affect next life. Not only that, karma were never exhausted. Whatever karma we have performed, whether good or bad, it never exhausted. It also left behind indefinitely effective karma. What is this indefinitely effective karma? I give an example. During Buddha's time, there was a monk called Chakupala. Chakupala. He strived very hard in order to attain arahantship. The moment he attained arahantship, he lost his eyesight. He became blind. So when he became blind while doing walking meditation, accidentally he stepped on many insects. So some of the monks reported to the Buddha, say that Chakupala killed insects because he stepped on many insects that caused death of the insects. Then the Buddha said that no, Chakupala stepped on the insect unintentionally. Why? Because Chakupala already became arahant. So he did not have any intention to kill any living beings. Then the monk was very surprised. He said that why he became arahant and yet he lost his eyesight. Then Buddha related one of his past life experience. Buddha said that in one of his past life, he was a physician. Eye specialist. One day, a female, a blind female, together with her daughter, come to this physician and ask whether this physician can cure her blindness or not. If the physician can cure her blindness, then this lady said that I and my daughter will become your slave forever. And this physician agreed to cure, to treat her blindness. And finally, he succeeded in treating her blindness, and she regained her eyesight. But when she regained her eyesight, she started to have fear. She said that, oh, me and my daughter have to become his slave forever. Then she feel remorse, and she told the physician, in order not to become his slave, then she told the physician, I still cannot see anything. She intentionally tell lies to the physician. I still cannot see anything. But the physician knew that she told lies. Okay, he said, you cannot see anything. Okay, let me try again. Let me try another medicine. So she put some medicine on her eyes and make her blind again. And because of this unwise action to cause this person, this lady blind again, because of this akusala karma, unwholesome karma, many lifetimes, life after life, when he was human being, he lost his eyesight. Even the last life, when he became arahant, he still lost his eyesight. This is called indefinitely effective karma. Because indefinitely means no end to it. As long as you are in the samsara, as long you are in the cycle of rebirth, this karma will never come to exhaustion, never exhausted. So in this case, Chakupala's case, who or whom should be blamed? is the lady to be blamed because she told lies? Or Chakupala should be blamed because he make her blind again? Who should be blamed? The lady or the physician? What do you think? I think both sides. Both sides also should be blamed. Therefore, but as a practitioner, we are responsible for our own actions. Even though the lady told lies, but as a practitioner, we cannot make a person blind again. Right? She told lies, this is her akusala karma, her unwholesome action. We don't have to punish her to make her blind again. If we try to punish her because of her lying and make her blind again, we ourselves perform akusala karma, and that karma, when ripened, come back to us, and we suffer accordingly. Therefore, as a practitioner, we don't try to see other people's fault. We don't try to see other people's mistake, but we take care of our own karma, so not to perform any unwholesome karma that in the future we will reap unwholesome result. This is the purpose of our practice. Try to stop the habitual pattern, habitual reaction of like and dislike. In this case, the physician do not like the lady telling lies. So his behavior, his habitual reaction is, I don't like you tell lies to me, so I punish you, making you blind again. Therefore, this physician follows his habitual reaction that caused himself suffering and also caused the lady to suffer again. So as a practitioner, what is the purpose of our practice? What is the immediate purpose? It's to stop our habitual reaction of like and dislike. Because this like and dislike will make us to perform unwholesome karma that leave behind three karmic potency. Number one is called current life effective karma. Number two is next life effective karma. And number third is indefinitely effective karma. And whatever karma we perform, we tend to hurt other people. We hurt other people as well as we hurt ourselves. We hurt both sides. So in order not to hurt anyone, including ourselves, we have to stop, overcome our habitual reaction of likes and dislikes. This is the immediate purpose. So if we can overcome our likes and dislikes and do not behave compulsively, then we already cut down many unwholesome karma. On the other hand, we accumulate a lot of good karma, and this good karma will follow us life after life. And we can abide in peace, happiness in the realm of rebirth. Okay. So immediate purpose is to undermine karmic potency. But this is not enough. This is not the ultimate purpose for a practitioner. Because a practitioner serious practitioner will not only stop at the immediate purpose. He will go one step further to ultimate purpose. So what is the ultimate purpose of the practice? What's your goal of your practice? The ultimate purpose of the practice is to see mind and body as they really are, in order to end suffering. Mind and body is conventional truth. Ultimate truth. This mind and body consists of five aggregates: materiality aggregate, feeling aggregate, perception aggregate, formation aggregate, and consciousness aggregate. 五蕴. So the ultimate purpose is to see five aggregates as they really are, in order to end suffering. Why suffer? Why suffering? Because of our attachment. Because of our attachment to the five aggregates, or our attachment to the mind and body. Then another question comes: why we attach to mind and body? Do you attach to your mind and body? Yes or no? Can I know the answer? Yes or no? Okay, good. You are honest. Why you attach? Now further question: why you attach to your mind and body? Why? Anyone want to try to give the answer? Why you attach to your mind and body? I cannot hear clearly here. Avijja. Ignorance, avijja. Okay. Good answer. Okay. Why we attach to mind and body? Because we think avijja, because avijja, we think, because of ignorance, we think mind and body provide us happiness. Right? Because we think mind and body give us happiness, and because mind and body give us enjoyment, pleasures. We enjoy six sense objects. We enjoy visible object, sound, smell, taste, tangible, and Dharma object. Through the body, through the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. Without this six sense basis, how can you enjoy pleasures? You cannot enjoy, just like a banana tree. Cannot enjoy any pleasures, because banana tree has no eye, ear, tongue, body, and mind. Therefore, we attach to mind and body because this mind and body give us chances, give us opportunity to enjoy life, to enjoy six sense objects. And when we enjoy six sense objects, we feel excited. We feel happy, excited. And this excitement and happiness cause us to cling to this mind and body. If mind and body all the time, when you were born until now, if mind and body only give you suffering, only give you misery, you will not attach to them. You will not attach to mind and body. But since we are born until now, most of the time we feel that mind and body give us happiness, give us enjoyment, therefore we attach to them. Buddha in the Samyutta Nikaya said, oh monks, whoever Brahmin or ascetics in the past, in the present, or in the future, regard in this world with pleasant things, with whatever has pleasant and happy nature in this world, as permanent, as happiness, as secure, as healthy, then they nurture craving. When they nurture craving, they nurture suffering. When they nurture suffering, they cannot free from suffering. Therefore, when you think the mind and body as pleasant, as permanent, then you nurture craving. When you nurture craving, you nurture suffering. When you nurture suffering, you cannot free from suffering. So avijja, ignorance, blind us to see five aggregates, blind us to see mind and body as happiness, as pleasant, as permanent. Therefore, we attach strongly to mind and body. And the ultimate purpose of the practice is to see five aggregates as they really are, as impermanent, as suffering, as non-self, in order to help us to let go attachment to them. So how these five aggregates, as impermanent, as suffering, as non-self, we will continue after the break. Okay? We'll break for 10 minutes. Okay, just now we talk about because we do not see the five aggregates of mind and body as they really are, as suffering, as impermanent, therefore we strongly attach to the mind and body. Just like a child, when he first see the firework, then he get fascinated, attracted by the firework because of the beauty of the firework. So he loved the firework. One day, out of curiosity, he touched that firework and get burned. Once he get burned, he know firework is dangerous. Firework is not as beauty as he previously think. Then, and because of the suffering of getting burned, then he start to keep distance from the firework. Now if you tell him, don't come close to firework, it's dangerous, then he will say, I know better than you. I have experienced it already. Therefore, we have to experience directly in order to get disenchanted with the mind and body. This is our ultimate purpose, the ultimate purpose of the practice. Then how to see? How to see the dangers? How to see the suffering nature? How to see the impermanent nature of mind and body? In order to see the suffering nature, impermanent nature of mind and body, direct observe mind and body. For example, the body. When you direct observe it, you will see the body only consists of four elements. Whatever in the body, there's hardness, roughness, is called earth element. Whatever in the body that is flowing, cohesion, there is water element. Whatever in the body that is warm, maturing, mature, cause the food to digest. This is, and cause the warm, keep the warm, warm the body. This is fire element. Whatever whatever in the body that is supporting or moving, that is a wind element. So if you discern the body from top of the head down to the sole, again, again, and again, you only see the four elements. You do not see the body form. What you see is only four elements. And if your concentration and wisdom matured, then you see this four element breaks down into many tiny particles. And what you experience is all the particles arising and passing away. There's no solidity of the body, it's just a lump of form arising and passing away. When you see something arising and passing away, then you know the nature of arising and passing away is beyond the control. You cannot control the process of arising and passing away. When something you cannot control, is it happiness or is it suffering? Which one? Suffering. Something you cannot control, how can it give you happiness? So whenever a practitioner sees past arising and passing away repeatedly, then he feels very oppressive. Being oppressed by constant arising and passing away, and that oppressive nature is called suffering. And what is impermanent, changing, and what is impermanent, changing, and suffering, how can we regard it as having abiding self? How can we regard it as permanent self? When we talk about self, S-E-I-F, self. When we talk about self, atta, it implies that something that we can control. But now, through your own experience, when you see the four elements in the body that keep on arising and passing away, which is beyond your control, then you know it is non-self. Non-self. So to see the non-self is something very special, very valuable experience. However, through my many years experience, through my many years of teaching, many yogis, although they already understand the ultimate goal of practice is to see anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanent, suffering, and non-self, but so many people, regardless woman or man, when they see no self, when they really experience no self, so many people become very fearful. Some even cry, shed their tears. Some stop meditation, don't want to continue anymore. I was very surprised. Because this is the goal. In order to be liberated, we have to experience what is non-self. But when this, many of people, many practitioners, when they really experience non-self, especially when they practice four elements meditation, when they see the four elements, then finally they lose the perception of self. And they start frightened, they get frightened. Then they say, I want to stop. I'm not going to continue anymore. I cannot live without a self. This shows that you know, how strongly human being cling to this self. Although they already understand the goal of the practice is to see non-self, but when they really see non-self, they become so panic, they become so frightened, they become so fearful, they cry, they stop meditation. So from this experience, you understand, huh, how strongly we cling to the self. Without self, we don't know how to live the world already. Yeah. So anyway, the ultimate goal is to see the fault and the danger of the body first. So when you experience, and when you practice four elements meditation, when you see no self and keep on arising and passing away, it's oppressive, it's suffering, then you start to see the body as it really is. Then the perception you had previously, you think the body gives you happiness, body is permanent, body provides you all the pleasures, now start to dissolve. Because now you experience directly, you see things, you see the body as it really is, as impermanent, suffering, and not an abiding self. When you see things, see body as it really is, then you start to let go the attachment. That attachment comes from ignorance. Attachment comes from not seeing things as they really are. But now when you start to see things as it really are, then you let go the attachment. Because the wisdom already arises. When wisdom arises, ignorance goes away. And when ignorance goes away, then you let go the attachment. But this only body. We still have mind to be let go of. To let go of the body, to let go the clinging to the body is very easy. But to let go the clinging to the mind is extremely difficult. Buddha in Samyutta Nikaya said that, if you a person sees the rise and fall, Buddha said to let go of the attachment to the body is very easy. Why? Because the decay of the body, the signal of the body is easily seen. One day you feel uncomfortable, this body ache, that ache, the headache, back ache. So it's very easy to discern, very easy to see the change of the body. But to let go the attachment to the mind, Buddha said, is extremely difficult, because in the round of rebirth, we identify mind as I, mind, myself constantly. For example, in this life, I pass away, I cast away my body. Another life, I take up another new body. I'm no more attached to my old body. But I still attached to the continuity of the mind. I still attached to the mind. So in order to let go the attachment to the mind, we have to see the fault, the danger of the mind. And this mind can be divided into four aggregates. Number one is called feeling aggregate. Number two, perception aggregate. Number three, formation aggregate. And number four, consciousness aggregate. Mind is very general only, but according to Sutta, you divide into four aggregates. If according to Abhidhamma, even more. Okay. So let us talk about the feeling aggregate first. We attach to feeling more than the body. When I come to the contact with, let's say, when I see the beloved person, we have pleasant feeling, and we attach to the pleasant feeling. In fact, we thought we have a lot of attachment to our son, our husband, our family members. I think it's not true. Why? In fact, we attach to the pleasant feeling that your spouse, your son, your daughter give to you. If your spouse, your husband or your wife do not give you pleasant feeling, you will not attach to her. So in fact, what we attach is the pleasant feeling we have, stimulated by other people. For example, now you love your wife. You love your wife. Why? Because your wife give you pleasant feeling. Now, if your wife go after with another man, do you still love your wife? No, because now your wife give you suffering, give displeasure feeling. So you hate this displeasure feeling. Because you hate this displeasure feeling, therefore you hate your wife. So in fact, what we attach is not attached to the person. Not attached to a son, daughter, husband, no. We attach to the pleasant feeling they give to you. You go back and think deeply. What I say is correct or not. So, we have to contemplate the feeling. Whatever feeling, in order to see the danger and the impermanence of the feeling, we need two mental factors. Number one, we need mindfulness. What it means mindfulness? Mindfulness means face to face with the feeling, face to face with the object. Let's say the object is feeling, our pleasant feeling. We come face to face with the pleasant feeling and yet do not react to the pleasant feeling. This is called mindfulness. If you know pleasant feeling and yet you react with greed, then I cannot say this is mindfulness. Mindfulness is non-reactive. You just know pleasant feeling has arisen in me. You just know pleasant feeling has arisen in me, but you do not react with craving. However, mindfulness alone not enough. But I know pleasant feeling has arisen in me. Then so what? So what? I also cannot liberate it from my pleasant feeling. So in order to be able to liberate it from the pleasant feeling, you have to contemplate the pleasant feeling as impermanent. Mentally you contemplate pleasant feeling as impermanent, 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 impermanent. This impermanent, the word of impermanent is very powerful. The moment you contemplate impermanent, impermanent, this word teaches your consciousness to let go. How can we attach to something which is not permanent? Right? So when you contemplate impermanent, impermanent, although you cannot see the feeling passes away so fast, but indirectly, the word of impermanent has taught you to let go to the pleasant feeling, don't attach. It's called wisdom. Wisdom. So therefore, in order to see the impermanency of pleasant feeling, we have to apply mindfulness and wisdom. Mindfulness, know it without react to it, and wisdom, contemplate it as impermanent, impermanent. When you contemplate impermanent, then you tune in, you synchronize your contemplation with the truth. Buddha says, "Sabbe sankhara anicca." All formations are impermanent. That is universal truth. The only thing in the world which is unchanged is change itself. So this is the truth. Changing, impermanent is the universal truth. So in order to see impermanent clearly, in order to experience impermanent clearly, you've got to tune in your mind. You've got to harmonize your mind with the truth. Only then the impermanency nature will reveal to you very clearly. If the truth is impermanent and your mentality is permanent, then there's no synchronize. So in order to synchronize with the truth, you've got to contemplate impermanent so that you can see impermanent very quickly. And also, when you contemplate impermanent, you sever the craving. Buddha said, when you see permanent, you nurture craving. When you see impermanent, you sever the craving. Craving is the cause of all suffering. Therefore, when you want to see the danger, the impermanent of feeling, contemplate impermanent. And when you contemplate impermanent, again, of course, first time, when you see contemplate impermanent, 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 you still feel very pleasant, very pleasant, very pleasant, no impermanent, because your mindfulness and wisdom is not mature enough. Therefore, you keep on practicing, keep on practicing until your mindfulness and concentration, your mindfulness and wisdom become matured. Then you will see feeling, whatever feeling, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, arise and passing away, arise and passing away in fast speed. Not now. Now it's not like now I contemplate impermanent, impermanent, impermanent. After 10 minutes, oh, I see it pass away. That's also insight, but slow insight. The real insight is the moment you see it, it passes away. However, this feeling arises again. The moment you see it, you contemplate impermanent, it passes away, but it does not stop there. It arises again. Then you contemplate again, then it subsides. But it arises again. And you contemplate again, it subsides, arises again, arising, passing away, arising, passing away, repeatedly. And every time when you contemplate impermanent of feeling, when it subsides, you feel bliss, peaceful, bliss. But when it arises again, you feel suffering. Then, as you contemplate, it passes away. It passes away, then you feel bliss again. So whenever you see it's arising, you feel suffering. Whenever you see it's subsiding, you feel bliss. So then after that, you understand. Very famous utterance of Buddha. Buddha said, whatever arising, whatever arises, is the arising of suffering. Whatever ceases, is the cessation of suffering. At that time, you will thoroughly understand this statement. And if you experience this one, fast arising and passing away, you see the suffering, at that time, you do not see any person, any being. You only see arising and passing away, and every arising is arising of suffering. Every cessation is a cessation of suffering. You do not see any human being, he, she, I, or a person. You only see suffering of arising, bliss of cessation. So this is how you can experience impermanence of feeling by applying mindfulness and wisdom. And when you really see the arising and passing away of feeling, then you let go. You become dispassionate. You become disenchanted. Previously, you are enchanted by the pleasant feeling. Whole your life, you chase after pleasant feeling, because pleasant feeling is so nice. So you strongly cling to it, you enchanted with the pleasant feeling without practical experience to see the impermanency of feeling. But now through practical experience, you see whatever feeling is just arising and passing away. It's impermanent, it's suffering, it's not a self. Then you become disenchanted. And you become disenchanted, then you become dispassionate. When you become dispassionate, you let go the attachment to the pleasant feeling, to whatever feeling. When your mind let go the attachment, your mind becomes liberated. Your mind becomes liberated and you are not, you no more agitated. You are free from agitation by non-clinging. So what is Nibbana? Nibbana is free from agitation by non-clinging. So this is how you can see the impermanence of feeling. See feeling as it really is. Now we come to perception. Perception, what is the meaning of perception? Perception means perceive things. When you see something, let's say when you first see elephant, so perception see the special quality of an object. So what is the special quality of an elephant? Now this, how to call? It's called tusk, right? Or ear, let's say the two big ear, like fan. So you remember, next time when you recognize, when you see the elephant again, through this two big ear, then you can recognize the elephant or this elephant, because previously you already make a mark. So perception make a mark so that you can recognize again. And because of this, suffering start to come. Let's say when we enjoy sensual pleasures, when we enjoy sensual pleasures, then first time we enjoy sensual pleasures, oh, it's very happyable, very lovable. So we make a mark. Sensual pleasures is very happy, lovable, agreeable, very pleasing, very enticing, and so on. So we make a mark. So next time when you enjoy the sensual pleasures again, you recognize it again. Oh, sensual pleasures give happiness. When sensual pleasure give enjoyment, happiness. So you recognize. Then you make a mark, recognize again and again, then it becomes deep rooted in your perception. Whatever sensual pleasures is happiness, is enjoyable. And whatever happiness and enjoyable, it becomes permanent. Your perception to it becomes permanent. So you perceive sensual pleasures is happiness, enjoyment, and permanent. This is called distorted perception. Vipalasa sanya. Distorted perception. And once you perceive wrongly, because first time you perceive sensual pleasures is happiness, permanent, one time you perceive wrongly, it imprints very deeply in our mental stream, and it becomes so difficult to change, so difficult to correct it again. Therefore, we become a slave of our perception. We become a slave of our pleasurable experience. So in order to see, to change our distorted perception, we have to contemplate whatever we eyes see, ear hears, nose smell, tongue taste, body touches, and mind think as impermanent, suffering, and non-self. This is called correct perception. So this is about the perception. And because of time factor, I want to go to the last one, consciousness. Consciousness aggregate. Consciousness aggregate, we also strongly identify all consciousness as I, mind, myself. For example, when I see something, because of the visible object that impinge to the eye sensitivity, that cause eye consciousness to arise to see something. So when all the factors are fulfilled, then I see something. So I is consciousness is conditional things. I consciousness see something is conditional. But because of ignorance, we do not understand, and we identify I consciousness as I. So we say I see something. We identify seeing as I, and we hear something because conditions are there. There's a sound, there's an ear sensitivity, there's an attention, there's a space that travel that make the sound impinge to the ear, but we do not understand all these conditioned things, and we identify, when you hear something, we identify all hearing process as I hear. Similarly, I smell, I taste. Who smells? Nose consciousness smells. Who tastes? Tongue consciousness tastes. Who touches? Body consciousness touches. Who think? Mind consciousness think. But we do not understand this correctly. So we identify I consciousness as I. We identify seeing consciousness as I. We identify hearing consciousness as I. We identify smelling consciousness as I. We identify tasting consciousness as I. We identify touching consciousness as I. We identify thinking as I. So we identify everything as I. So we strongly cling to this I. So in order to see the consciousness as it really is, it's not a self. So we have to investigate conditional phenomena. What causes I consciousness to see something? What causes I consciousness to arise? In order to let I consciousness to arise, you need visible object, you need eye sensitivity, you need light, you need attention. So when all these factors are fulfilled, then eye consciousness arrive to see something, then immediately it passes away. So if we can see in this way, then we see things as they really are. We see consciousness as it really is. When we see consciousness as it really is, that they are conditional things, they are impermanent, they are not a permanent self, then we let go the attachment to the I. We let go the attachment to the self. So how to let go our attachment to the mind and body? So now we come back again to the question, how to let go our attachment to the mind and body? In order to let go our attachment to mind and body, we must see the danger and the faults of mind and body. So what are the dangers? What are the faults of mind and body? The dangers and the faults of mind and bodies are, they are impermanent. They are changing all the time. Because of changing, repeatedly change, they are suffering. And because they are changing, they are suffering, they cannot be regarded as a permanent self. So anicca, dukkha, anatta, these are the dangers, are the faults of mind and body. So the ultimate purpose of the practice is to see the anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanent suffering and non-self of mind and body in order to let go the attachment to them. Without clearly see them, we have strong attachment to them. And without clearly see them is because of ignorance. So only when you put into a practice, you remove the ignorance, then you clearly see the true nature of mind and body. And this is the ultimate purpose of our practice. And when you really see the impermanent suffering and non-self of mind and body, and you let go of the attachment, because of letting go of attachment, the happiness grows day after day. When you let go of the attachment, you feel you release the burden. There's no more burden, then you feel light, you feel relief, then you feel happy. So your happiness increases. Your happiness increases day after day. And from your own experience, you also develop compassion for other people. You also develop compassion for other people who still have strong attachment to mind and body. Because you already understand, attachment is the cause of all suffering. But many people still not reach this point yet. So they still suffer owing to their own attachment. Then you start to develop compassion for them. You want to share your experience with them, to let them understand also the fault and the danger of mind and body, so that they also can let go of the attachment, and finally they can live happily without attachment. So this is how the compassion comes, to help other people. Okay, so as a conclusion here, as a conclusion for today's talk, the spiritual practice, there are two purposes for the spiritual practice. Number one is to overcome our habitual reaction of likes and dislikes. Why? Because the habitual reaction of likes and dislikes leave behind karmic tendency, leave behind three karmic tendencies: current life effective karma, next life effective karma, and indefinitely effective karma. And whatever karma we perform, we hurt ourselves and we hurt other people. So in order to protect ourselves and to protect other people, we have to overcome our habitual pattern of behavior. And this habitual pattern of behavior will carry to the next life and shape our character, shape our personality. And we become angry type of person, we become greed temperament, or we become jealousy temperament, or we become delusion temperament. This is first purpose, immediate purpose. And the ultimate purpose is to realize mind and body, and is to realize five aggregates are impermanent, suffering, and non-self, in order to let go the attachment to them. Without let go the attachment to mind and body, there's no happiness at all. Because attachment itself is the origin of all suffering. It's the second noble truth. The first noble truth is five aggregates of clinging. Five aggregates of clingings are the truth of suffering. And the origin of the truth of suffering is craving. Craving for existence. Existence of what? Existence of five aggregates. Or craving of craving for sensual pleasures. Without five aggregates, how you enjoy sensual pleasures? You cannot enjoy sensual pleasures. So you must have five aggregates, then you can enjoy sensual pleasures. Therefore, craving, either craving for existence or craving for sensual pleasures, are the truth of suffering. And what are the what is the path? What is the path to the third one is the cessation of suffering. What is the cessation of suffering? Removal, the same craving is the cessation of suffering. Because since craving is the origin of suffering, then when you remove the craving, then you reach the cessation of all suffering. But how to reach there? How to achieve this purpose? Through the path, we said Noble Eightfold Path. What we understand Noble Eightfold Path, there are eight factors: right view, right thoughts, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. in one of the sutta in Sangyutta Nikaya, Buddha used another way to explain this Noble Eightfold Path. How Buddha explained? Buddha said, when you contemplate impermanence of five aggregates, this is called, such view is called right view. And when you always think of impermanence of five aggregates, such thought is called right thought. And if you put effort, to contemplate impermanent suffering nature of five aggregates, such effort is called right effort. And if you always remember, not forgetful, always remember five aggregates or mind and bodies are impermanent suffering and non-self, such remembering is called right mindfulness. And if your mind focuses on the impermanent suffering and non-self, such concentration is called right concentration. And if you already keep five precepts, if you do not indulge in wrong livelihood, then you fulfill right speech, right livelihood, and right action. So all these eight factors are fulfilled. So the path leading to the cessation of suffering is constantly contemplate impermanent suffering and non-self nature of mind and body until you get rid of the attachment. When you get rid of the attachment, it's the cessation of all suffering. So this is the ultimate purpose of our practice. This is the end of my talk. Thank you. Okay, when you close the eyes, the mind goes up. Let it go up. You don't have to do anything. As long as you are aware. As long as you are aware what is in your mind, the mind goes up, like lift up. If your goes up similar with lifting up, that's good. So just know it. You don't have to do anything. Just know it, the mind goes up. As long as you are mindful, nothing will happen to you. Just apply your mindfulness, then this problem will be. Goes up doesn't mean bad. It can be good state. So just mindful. No, the mind goes up. That's all.
The second question. During meditation, the body and legs shake. Worry. Anything wrong?
This is a good question. Many people experience this. When during meditation, sometimes body will sway, shake. Some people think that, wow, 走火入魔了. Something ought to happen. If I don't experience the qi, I may not be able to answer you. However, I experience it myself, so I can tell you very frankly, very directly, nothing wrong. When we come to meditation, our qi move very smoothly, better than you when your mind is restless. The concentrated mind produces zhen qi, correct energy, pure energy in the body. So this pure energy in the body is trying to heal you. Heal, H-E, not kill, huh? H-E-A-L. If you listen wrongly, become wrong answer, huh? So this pure energy, because it's produced by right concentration, concentrated mind is a good mind. Every mind state can produce energy in the body. So concentration, good state of mind, produce good energy in the body. And if your body have some blockage, so this energy is trying to heal you. So when it heal you, it try to move you. So your body will shake, you know, like sway, shake. But if you want to let it stop, it also can stop. Don't shake, then it immediately stop. So if this thing happen, if your body sway and shake in the public retreat, I will advise you, don't sway, don't shake, because you frighten people. When people, especially non-Buddhists, if they just come and visit, meditator, wow, this meditator is swear like anything. Oh, I don't want to meditate anymore. He will run away. Okay. But if you are practicing at home, I will recommend you continue swear, continue shake the body, because it's the right time for you to heal your body. After you swear and shake, then you will see, you will feel that your body is energized. You feel very healthy, very light, energized, because your pure energy, the zheng qi, is trying to push away all your blockage, all your zuo qi. Many of my students reported this to me already. Wherever I go, Australia, USA, Indonesia, you know, and Malaysia, everywhere, many people ask me this question. And I am very fortunate because I experienced it myself. So I know what is happening. Therefore, I can give you this answer. So don't worry, nothing wrong. If you practice alone, you want to heal your body, this is the right time you can heal your body. But if you in the public, you just stop it, don't do it. Okay?
The third question. When in meditation, once you stop, that cannot come out. If we were to force our eyes open, what then wrong? What should be done? Thank you and really appreciate for answering. Please do come more often to Singapore. You can come.
Okay, so when in a good meditation, this person say, when in a good meditation, she says, I don't know whether she or he cannot come out. Cannot come out. I just finished a 10-day retreat in Penang. One of my students also reported to me. She says she go into the good state, but cannot come out. And she has asked so many masters already. No one can solve her problem. So I told her, okay, before you go to this good state, make a determination first. So when I go into this state, before you go in, tell yourself, I want to stay in this state for 1 hour only. Aditana, make determination first, say that, okay, within 5 minutes, I will go into this good state. And I want to stay in that good state for 1 hour. Then after that, you start meditation. After 1 hour, you will automatically come out from that state. If you don't believe me, you can check your watch. But if you don't make this determination, then you go in, you don't know how to come out. It's like mind is very powerful. You already incline your mind. I'm going to come out 1 hour, and because of your concentration, concentrated mind is very powerful. So immediately 1 hour, you automatically come out. So you try next time. Make a determination first before you go into your deep meditation. Nothing wrong, nothing happened to you. So we have a lot of fear and doubt because we don't have teacher to ask. If you, as long as you practice with qualified teacher, nothing will happen to you. But if you practice alone, sometimes something may happen because there's no answer. Then you get fear. And when you get fear, then you stop meditation, which is a loss.
Okay.
Dear Venerable,
can we know our past
lives
through meditation?
Can we see our past life?
Can we know?
Oh, can we know our past life through meditation? Of course. But you need strong concentration. You need strong concentration. But you think that I cannot concentrate well. And yet I'm so keen to know my past life, what to do. That's one way I can recommend you to do. Go hypnosis. Go hypnotize. When you're hypnotized by other people, you may be able to see your past life. Previously, before I read all this hypnosis book, Cui Men, I also don't believe what hypnosis, I don't believe it. But last year when I was in USA, this year, the beginning of the year, I had read so many hypnosis books. When after hypnotized, they see their past life. And what they see, only cause and effect. What they see, only karma. Exactly same as Buddha's teaching. Therefore, if you very eagerly to see your past life and yet you don't have concentration to see, you can try hypnosis. Okay, you can see your past life if you have concentration. Okay.
Yes, Annie. If we are practicing with a group of new meditators without a teacher, how can we guide them without fear of giving the wrong advice? Thank you, Sadhu.
How can you guide them? You yourself must qualify enough. If you yourself have no experience and you want to guide other people, it's like blind lead the blind. So if you want to guide other people, you want to teach other people, you want to guide other people, especially meditation, you yourself must experience first. Not only experience, your own experience also not enough. You also must have interact with many meditators already. For example, I am Pao Xiaorong's interpreter, you know, for many years abroad or in Burma. So I have listened to thousands of people's experience. Everybody have to go through me in order to reach Pao Xiaorong. Those who cannot speak English one. So they have to go through me in order to reach Pao Xiaorong. So I have listened to so many people's experience. Because personal one people's experience not enough. You know, you have to handle thousand people's experience. Therefore, one own practical experience sometimes also not enough. You must expose to thousand people's experience, then you become a good teacher. So if you want to lead a new meditator, make sure you have certain experience in order to lead people more efficiently, effectively. And also you like what Pao Xiaorong always want in his eye what is the qualified teacher. He said qualified teacher, if he has practical experience, of course is the best, but still not enough. He also must have theoretical knowledge, especially all the Sutta Abhidhamma knowledge. Because as a meditation teacher, you need to answer all sorts of questions. Sometimes people ask certain things which is beyond your knowledge. Then how can you answer people? Therefore, you must have very strong pariyatti knowledge, learning knowledge. You must understand Abhidhamma, you must understand Sutta, in order to become a really qualified meditation teacher. Only meditation alone still not enough to satisfy other people, because many people have many different questions. And also as a meditation teacher, let's say, you also must have two aspects, vipassana and samatha. I have many people reported to me, say that they see the light. Light. And when they see the light, when they reported to other teachers who have no concentration practice, who only practice pure vipassana, no concentration. So to them, the light is very unfamiliar to them. So when such people reported to such type of teacher, they will say, no, not important. Contemplate impermanent, impermanent until light disappear. But to concentration practice, samatha practice, this light is very, very important. In order to go into deep jhana, better, deeper concentration, this light is important. We have to keep the light, not to let it disappear, not to contemplate impermanence. Therefore, as a qualified meditation teacher, you must have both vipassana and samatha. Only then you can guide people more thoroughly, more correctly. If you only have vipassana, you never know how to guide those who have concentration. Through our teaching, we know many people have concentration. In their past, they have practiced concentration. They easily see the light. But if they don't have the opportunity to meet with the correct teacher who have concentration base, then they miss the chance to attain jhana. Okay?
There's another question. Can we see past lives through hypnosis? However, during this period of hypnosis, the state of mind is in a state of semi-consciousness, and that the strong concentration required during meditation. Could we actually be imagining things during hypnosis? And is this actually inferior as compared to recalling the past lives through meditation?
Can I see the notes? Thank you. Sometimes I cannot hear clearly. Thank you.
Seeing past lives through hypnosis, during hypnosis, the state of mind is in semi-conscious state, unlike strong concentration required during meditation. Could we be imagining things during hypnosis, and is this an inferior state?
Inferior state?
Yeah.
I think this person think I am expert in hypnosis. I only read many books only. I'm not an expert in hypnosis. However, in order to make your hypnosis more effective, you need very qualified one. According to what I read, they are still conscious, but they just follow what the hypnosis tell you. Then, for example, you go up to the staircase, you go down, then you reach a door, then you open the door, then your mind go through space, then you reach another life already. But usually one time not successful. You must try many times. And also you must be very, very relaxed. Your mind like half sleepy, not really sleepy and half sleepy, very, very relaxed, then only you can be able to recollect to your past. It doesn't need concentration. Hypnosis doesn't need concentration. You just need to work with that, that expert. Follow his instruction, then your mind as relaxed as possible. If your mind do not relax, you cannot go into that like half sleepy state. So is it inferior? Many people after going through hypnosis, they cure their phobia. It's called phobia? Phobia. They can cure their phobia. And also many people after going through hypnosis, for example, this lifetime, he was abused, sexually abused when he was a child. Or his family, he hate his father. For example, I just read one hypnosis report. This woman, when she was just born, she has very strong dislike to her father. When her father touched her, she immediately, tried to against his touch. So she cannot understand why. Then finally, when she went under the hypnosis, Then she realized, because in the past life, she was sexually abused by her father. And this father is her present father, present life father. So you can see the cause and effect. So after hypnosis, they see the cause and effect. Then they start to understand many things. Then they say, the only thing, what can I do is forgive. Forgive. So those who under hypnosis, the character start to change. They change to a better person. Anyway, I'm not trying to advertise hypnosis. Don't misunderstand. So everybody got hypnosis. No one to practice concentration anymore. But anything which is good, good for you, why not try, right?
Are there any more questions? Allah
could
see Buddha Sansa walking on stage to present a token of
peace.
Oh.